And I guess we're going to keep revisiting this place about the imagination. What is the imagination? What are we talking about? What earth are we doing here? Where's my tea? Okay. possibly do a talk without my tea.
You asked three questions, and you answered one.
I know. I answered the easier one of where's my tea, because I've just found it. The more difficult question is, what are we doing here, and what is the imagination anyway? And why are we studying all these old stories, images of the tree of life, doing peculiar chants? Why should we do this? You know, why, if you read Jung, is he obsessively looking at alchemical manuscripts, looking at old, again, same thing, very old traditions? Well, I guess there's probably lots of reasons for why we're doing this, but one of the reasons is because we live in a very extroverted, externalized culture where the images have gone right outside and got away from us. There's something about the processes that have happened around industrialization, around the development of the colonial empires of the West, the rise of scientific rationalism, that have really have all kinds of, maybe good, well, had good and bad effects, I think. But one of the, but in particular, the area that we're looking at, which is the area, if you like, the human soul, for want of a better word, or human subjectivity, becomes less and less valued. And in some ways, understandably, because what happens as technology develops through the 19th century, much of it from Britain, bizarrely. You often wonder why do things happen in particular places, and you know, because for Britain, this tiny little island becomes this enormous world power through the power of its technology and its ability to make better guns than anybody else. But it is through things like the development of steam, the development of industrial, the creation of factories, the creation of the ability to mass produce things, to the great iron foundries, the shipbuilding industries. So we create this extraordinary navy ability to, within these ironclad ships with great guns that can, dominate the world in some ways. There's a famous 18th century Prime Minister Palmerston, who, a British citizen gets into, a very dubious British citizen who's actually Portuguese, gets into trouble with the Greek government for embezzlement and all kinds of fraud, and perhaps quite rightly he's put into prison. Palmerston demands that, because he is a British, he claims his British citizenship somehow, so he claims the protection of the British embassy, and the British Prime Minister Palmerston demands that the Greek government release him, sends a couple of gunboats to Athens harbour, and tells them he will shell the Acropolis unless they release the citizen of Britain. And he uses this interesting kind of term that in the days of the Roman Empire, if you were a Roman citizen, you had great power and rights. You could walk, you would say, Civis Romanus sum, I am a citizen of Rome. So local authorities, local provincial authorities would take on or imprison the citizen of Rome at their peril, because the legions would follow on that. Now, Palmerston has the same image, and not the same image, the same phrase. He says to Parliament, a dramatic speech, Civis Britannicus sum, I am a citizen of Britain. And therefore, you have the same rights and power as a citizen of Rome. Now, we've got to sort of try and, if we can, try and think ourselves back into that kind of mindset, because this is the matrix out of which the world we now live in develops. You know, it's a world where the white European dominate the world, because actually, you know, the European powers go all over the world, stripping it really. You know, we steal the sort of the Elgin marbles. We sort of, you know, it's a classic colonial thing that imperial centres collect the wealth of the empire towards the centre. And they do this, and these powers can do this because of their superior technology. You know, Britain at one point, for example, goes to war with China for the right to sell opium. The Chinese emperor was trying to clean up the kind of the opium trade, and Britain is making a lot of money out of the opium trade. So we go to war with China in order for the right. So basically, Britain at this point is an enormous drug cartel, you could say, making war on China because it wants to continue to sell opium. Now, we have to kind of think in some ways, what is the effect really of living inside that imperial mindset, which we're at the tail end of now, although, you know, within our lifetimes, you know, we went to war with Argentina, for Christ's sake, on the same basis. A tiny little island, rightly called the Malvinas, which are, and in some ways, you know, you can see these echoes of the imperial adventure in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in our desire to join ourselves to America, to be part of their imperium. You know, we live in the days of the American Empire now. But the effect of all of this, the effect of this mindset is an interesting one, I think, in that it transfers human power to the external, to those who can make the machines. And in particular, those who make the machine, you know, we have to look also for the 19th century, we have to look at Karl Marx and his understanding of the rise of capitalism because of the power of the machine. Because of the ability, so you see this rising class of capitalists who are the people that own the means of production, who have this capacity, have these machines that make things that then dominate the world in some way. Now, I'm not actually saying that pre-capitalism is an idyllic place. It really wasn't. It's sort of, you know, if we go back beyond the industrialization, there's massive, certainly in Britain, but across Europe, there's massive class divisions, massive oppression, massive xenophobia. None of this is created by the world of machines and the world of industrialization. But one of the things that existed in previous generations is a sense of continuity, a sense of connection with land and community that gets massively destroyed through the 18th century industrialization, because what happens is everything come people, materials, everything has to come into the cities in order to enable the new world to come into being. You know, so you get folk songs about, you know, lines like Hell and Halifax from the Dalesman Litany, Hell and Halifax and Hell, good Lord, deliver me. Because, and it's a social commentary upon a movement of the emptying out of the dales. You know, in different contexts, you see the clearances in Scotland because of the kind of imperial demands and development needs. So what you start to see is a stripping, a destruction of traditional kind of cultures and traditional ways of understanding. So that what you see coming into being is a new world of wealth and power that's about somehow being part of the machine, being part of industrialization, finding a way to kind of get in on the act of all that. And then what does that do to the human spirit? I mean, you have that wonderful image from Charlie Chaplin film about the man in the machine. You've got this wonderful image of the clown figure, of Charlie Chaplin's clown, being worked by cogs. And if we start to think about, you know, what is it like, what, you know, what is it like to be in a 19th century industrial factory? Well, the chaplain image is incredibly profound somewhere. You know, it's that's what happens. It's repetitive. I mean, one of the modern analogues here, I mean, the sweatshops are still operating now. They're just outsourced now to China and places where we can't see them. They're cheaper. But what does that do to the human spirit, that repetitiveness, that dumbing down, that constant grind? So you come out of work exhausted. Men, women, children, all somehow funneled into the factory, enabling. I mean, this is where Marxism, in a sense, comes in, where all the wealth, mostly, not all, that's an exaggeration, most of the wealth goes to people who just siphon it off. You do get Victorian philanthropists as well who plough back some of that and are trying to give some of that back. But what it does is to take people away from their traditional customs, traditional ways of understanding the world. It brings into being a powerful new world where if you're going to be powerful in this world, you have to learn how to live in this world. So all these stuff, old folk rituals, old songs, old stories, you know, they're quaint, they're interesting, but they're not important. Because actually we're moving into the new age, this sort of, also the rise of science, the kind of, you know, and this is a good thing. The rise of science is a brilliant thing. It's not, you know, sometimes sitting around Glastonbury, you have people yearning for an old bucolic kind of fairyland, and it never was a fairyland. It was brutish and nasty in lots of ways. But just one of the casualties of that process is the understanding of human subjectivity and the understanding of the power of the imagination, even while the human imagination was creating these extraordinary machines, an extraordinary world. Very complex. At the same time, there was a sort of underground process going on where, certainly in music, in the folk music traditions, people are, while they're in the factories, they're creating new ballads, new songs, and in very small places, stories are being preserved and retold and remembered and reinvented. You know, for example, one of the things that happens in the 18th century in Britain is that we get the Druidic revival appears. So to a guy called Iolo, yeah, so there is reaction. So you get people like William Blake, people like Iolo Morganwg. So you get the reaction too. So, and this reaction arises out of places like poetry and romantic revivalists. We get the Celtic Twilight revival. You know, where people get fascinated in the old Celtic stories, write new versions of them, and so there's a whole counterbalance, if you like, to the, you know, so Peter Pan gets written, you know, and King Charles Kingsley writes things like the Water Babies, very sometimes sentimental, awful things, but there's a reaction to that other world. But one of the problems of it is that it situates the imagination is either in the high art or in the frivolous or in the romantic. So it doesn't feel substantial. The substantial thing is the world of machines and politics and power. And we've got these rather beautiful, nice old traditions, which we mustn't forget about, but they are not meaningful in the same way that the steam engine is meaningful. And we associate the imagination with these rather wispy things or they're associated with very exquisite, beautiful things like great artists can produce great art, which can be sold for great amounts of money, so acquires value in that way. If we read Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto, this is a profound work of the imagination. It is, you know, it's idealistic. It has all kinds of, you know, there's many things you could say about it, probably. But it is certainly a profound work of the imagination, of somebody sitting in the middle of their world, looking at what is happening, and seeing and imagining another possibility. It's not easy to think of communism as an imaginative tradition, and really, because it, you know, I always think suddenly about these posters of heroes of the revolution. You have these kind of chunky men and women with big spanners in their hands, and of course a lot of those images have been used in very suppressive and very kind of awful ways. But they are, the imagination is about, fundamentally about human life, so it is everywhere. Right now, UKIP are imagining a world without Europe. I don't know what Labour and the Tories are imagining. They're too ambiguous. Their imagination, you see, what other vision, you know, in some ways you can start to think about imagination and vision and what is held up to us. What are the visions operating in our times? Now, one of the visions that seems to be operating in our times is, let's not get into trouble and let's blur everything and let's try and stay in the middle, because maybe we'll get into power that way as long as nobody finds us out. I mean, that's almost one of the kinds of wispy kind of political visions, is why partly is one of the reasons why I think why UKIP is doing very well, is they're drawing on the ancient xenophobic traditions of Britain, and they're conjuring up an image, an old image of Britain, a ridiculous image of Britain before there were immigrants. So if we really take that properly, everybody should go home except as Welsh. So all the rest of you are immigrants, let's be honest. But, you know, it's a sort of insane image, isn't it? I mean, because actually these islands in particular, I mean, all countries actually, but an island people depend upon the movement of trade and the movement of peoples and people continually coming and revivifying things. But as against that, you know, so as people get frightened in the age that we live in, the image, the imagination of UKIP, or the imagination of the British, collective imagination of the British people somewhere, or part of it, has created UKIP. And we have this image of Nigel Farage, who is... He's a powerful image. I mean, if you look at Nigel Farage, and you look at him, look at Nigel Farage against David Cameron, Neil and Clegg. Can't remember Clegg's first name. What's his name?
Nick.
That's right. He's so bland, so bland. And what's the other one?
Miliband.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So. If we just look at them, Farage is interesting, I think. I mean, he's positioned himself. He's the beer drinking kind of, you know, the bit of a laugh, bit of a lad, tells the truth, you know, as it gets. So he's, you know, I mean, he's a clever politician. He's manipulating images. And in a way, that's kind of the problem that we face in our society. That actually everything is, there's a powerful cultural tendency that is about the outside having more substance than the inside. If the imagination is allowed at all, it's allowed in very particular places.
Well, it seems to me that all political parties, the one way they use the imagination of the electorate as a resource is in fear and control.
Totally, yeah.
You know, because the terrorism thing, the constant red and green lights about threats, perceived threats. And that. I mean, just Farage does it targeting particular groups, they all do it. And that's how they erode our civil rights, isn't it?
Yeah.
By saying they can legislate to get rid of our fear.
No, exactly, that's right. And so the reality is that the imagination is probably the most powerful capacity that we have. It's also the energy, you know, the whole thing that advertising depends on. Advertising depends on us engaging our imaginations to believe that if we buy the thing that buy the thing they want us to buy, that we will be happy. But we have to imaginatively identify. It's been interesting how the development of advertising over time is that it started off, I think of, what was it? Ozo?
Oxo.
Hmm?
No?
Not Oxo, no. Washing powder. What's the...
Omo.
Omo. Okay. If I think of the very earliest Omo ads, where you really, it's a very, very simple little story, kind of, you know, whiter than white. Omo washes whiter than white, and then and you're given this image of the grey clothes and white clothes and sort of, and then there's an ecstatic kind of woman who's sort of, you know, kind of whiter than white, and the ding. So that's a very simple story. Now, the stories have got more and more complex in advertising because they need to, because as we get more sophisticated, whiter than white, we don't easily identify with that. So, you get car ads that don't tell you it's a car ad. Right? You have this kind of powerful experience, this fire chasing you, but you get it, you know, and it's beautiful and smooth. And they're catching, the attention is to catch your imagination, to get you to identify with that, and to, in a sense to, because in that moment what happens, you experience feelings maybe of power, beauty, stillness, and they get you or want you to identify that with the object they want you to buy. So that what they're saying in that is these qualities can only exist in you if you can buy this, whereas actually the qualities that you're experiencing actually arise from your own center, your own experience. And in a way, this is always the problem, I think,